everybody treated the soaps sort of as, oh, they're kind of silly sister who nobody took seriously, but everybody loved, and so nobody ever criticized it because she was a little bit, flighty and not too smart. And so the soap industry sort of got used to being handled with nothing but adoration. When we came along and we wanted to write criticism, people were taken aback. I mean, when we would give someone a B in rating The Replacements, some of those people would never talk to us again.
On this edition of the Daytime Confidential podcast, Luke and I welcome a true soap opera industry pioneer, Miss Mimi Torchin, founding editor of Soap Opera Weekly. Mimi, thank you so much for coming on our show.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted to be here, and it's so nice, you know, to hear you say founding editor-in-chief of Soap Opera Weekly instead of Soap Opera Digest, which is something that I think I had a fight about my whole career. We were always sort of the poor stepchild, but we did pretty well for ourselves.
So tell us a little bit about how you got started covering daytime.
Well, it was interesting. I was a theater critic. I came to New York to be an actress, and then I became a writer, and was a critic and a columnist for Q Magazine, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was the time out of the time when I came to New York 40 years ago. And when I became a freelance writer, somebody called me about I worked at the Star for 3 weeks on the desk that did soap opera stories. It was kind of interesting because really I hadn't had any particular connection to the industry. I'd taken a soap opera acting class and I'd watched soaps, of course, and I was interested in it. And then I had the opportunity, someone called me to do a magazine for Sterling Magazine called Soap Opera's Greatest Stories, just to write it myself. It was a quarterly, and I said, okay, I'll do it. And I had to really take crash course in watching all the soaps because we had to cover all of them. And I basically wrote the whole magazine by myself. We changed the name to Soap Opera's Greatest Stories and Stars because it was a storyline magazine. I said, oh, no, I can't just, you know, write about storylines. I said, we have to have some, you know, live people here, some real life stuff. So we changed the format a little bit of that. And I did that, you know, as a freelancer for 8 years, and then went over to the Digest and did the thumbs up, thumbs down column because criticism was actually my background after theater. That's really what I did a lot of. And then Meredith Brown called me and said, are you interested in talking about a business proposition? And I said, sure, I'm always interested in talking. I went over and met with her, and Murdoch had just bought the Digest for about $70 million and heard that the Inquirer was going to start a weekly tabloid-sized magazine, and he didn't want to go bi-weekly with the Digest, and so he basically wanted to start a magazine to stop that magazine. I mean, this is really why we came into existence. And I met a few people, and, you know, we talked about format a little bit because it had to be different from the Digest, which is why what actually made Soap Opera Weekly what it was, is that we had to differentiate ourselves and in some way. And so I got the job, and in 6 weeks we had our first issue on the stand. I mean, it was like a whirlwind. I think I started off with 5 staff members. And no publicity, no nothing. We just appeared. And we were a success from our first issue. It was absolutely phenomenal.
Amazing.
It really was amazing. It was amazing. I'd never done anything like that. I'd never, you know, had a staff. None of us had ever had weekly experience except for my art director, who'd come from the Star, was very talented, Susan Rohal. And we were inventing ourselves as we went along. We had to be a news magazine. But at the time we started in 1989, there was no such thing as soap opera news. It really was not a category. We created soap opera news. And I mean, it's so ubiquitous now. Spoilers, the what will happen, the coming events, the previewing, the industry news, all of that started really with us. It got out of control. I mean, that's all there exists now, really. People care about.
Back then, But that was before the internet and before a lot of the
before
online.
Before the internet. The internet was just starting, and we were the first magazine, Luke, really, that's it. We were the first magazine that you could pick up and you could read about what you were watching on TV as you read it. Even the Digest, which was a biweekly, really, because it had no competition, really didn't care about timeliness. As timely as it was it did its recaps. Most of soap magazines were about, you know, being a fan magazines, and doing recaps. And that's what most of the journalism, and not journalism, it wasn't journalism, there wasn't really journalism. It was mostly, that's what the newspapers would carry. They'd carry recaps, except for people like, my brain just went dead, Linda, who was in Cleveland. Anyway, it'll come back to me in a second. It's a senior moment. And then Linda Sussman did a newsletter that had a little bit of, meat to it. And I think Logan maybe was he might have been doing his criticism by then. But basically it was just recaps and fan stuff. Nothing about what was happening on the screen. And we literally invented that out of necessity. Out of the necessity not to do what the Digest was, which was basically a fan magazine. So they said, well, what are you going to do for news? I said, that's a good question. Why don't we take the storylines, and we'll find out if we can get some previews, and we'll talk to the actors about their motivation. We'll talk to the writers about why they did certain things. We'll make news out of the storylines. And that's what we did. I mean, besides, the behind-the-scenes stuff, which we did a lot of, we sort of took entertainment
journalism
Night as our guide.
Oh.
Yeah, because they were really the first magazine show that went behind the scenes, talked about grosses and box office, and they got away from that as we become more celebrity oriented again. But that was really what they were sort of known for, was telling you the inside, letting you be an insider. And that was what we did, in addition to treat our readers with great respect, never talk down to them.
In founding the magazine, you said that you were a success from the moment you launched, which is an accomplishment, because it seems like today all you hear about is magazines that launch and go under within the first year to 3 years. Do you think?
Absolutely. And also because we had no support. We had no, there was no advertising for us. What Murdoch did was what he was brilliant at it also, which was placement. We had very good pocket placement, and they kept on saying, well, if you write a few words, we'll put a little, we'll put a promo in the Star. But I was trying to, in 6 weeks, to put together a staff and put out my first issue of a weekly magazine with a bunch of people who'd never done that. I mean, a bunch of people, six of us. We were bare-bones staff. I didn't have time to sit down and write advertising copy. And by the time I got around to it, we were launching. It was too late. And so we just ended up, people just sort of walked by a pocket and saw us in the grocery store, and the mail that we would get, you can't imagine. We would get mail like, where have you been all my life? This is the magazine I've been dreaming of. Did I just die and go to heaven? I mean, the response, and we would get all, I have to drive 50 miles to get your magazine. My aunt sends me the magazine from, Memphis. We only had half a 500,000 distribution for ages. In fact, I think we started with 250,000. And, the demand, it's really quite fascinating, because it just was the right product done in the right way at the right time. And we just presaged the internet madness that happened,
Do you ever wish you could have been a few years earlier when in the quote unquote soap heyday?
I do. We actually, things were still pretty lively when we were around. I was just looking at our first issue. It's in just preparation to talk to you. I just went back to see our very first issue. And the Nielsen's, Y&R, had an 8-1 rating with a 29 share. And there were 12 soaps. Generations was the lowest rated at 2.710. That's like a high now.
Kidding.
That's the whole middle of the field is in that range now. And I do wish we had a few more years on the other side of it, but I'll tell you, we were really riding kind of a crest at the time. And because things were still healthy, there was still an interest, there were still stuff to be done about soaps. There was still a ways for it to go. And because we did what we did in such a new and fresh way, and we really did, because nobody told me what to do. And I sort of didn't come from a soap background. I came from a different kind of a background, a different kind of a magazine and a writing background. And I thought, well, let's treat soaps like, you know, like they're not an industry joke, that they're not something that people have to be embarrassed to say that they're watching. Let's try to help legitimize a really fabulous industry that takes a lot of hits unfairly from the rest of the entertainment industry, from people in general who don't know them. And so that's what kind of drove us. And because that was something fresh and soaps were still riding a pretty good crest, I really have no complaints.
You definitely legitimized soap opera journalism. I know I was one of the people that you're talking about that wrote in that loved it. I mean, people talk about appointment television. My grandmother and I made an appointment for years to head to the Barnes & Noble on Fridays to pick it up. Tried subscribing, but it always got to the newsstand before it got to my house.
Before
and I couldn't
it got
wait.
Here, yes.
So
our
I would end up.
That was always a problem. But that's okay, because we were mostly newsstand. I mean, we had very – that's another reason we were so successful, is because we didn't build our circulation on – they didn't go – because we were selling so phenomenally, they didn't bother to do anything subscription-wise except through the magazine. You know, we didn't get involved in any of the Publisher's Clearinghouse or any specials or any mailings or anything till way, way, way later, when we had a lot more advertising and they wanted to perhaps reach a little bit larger group. But we had such phenomenal sell-throughs at the newsstand that we were almost all newsstand-driven. And it was because, as you say, people really, really, really responded to the magazine. We cared very deeply about our readers. It was, you know, it was really important to me that we had a magazine that spoke to people with intelligence, that didn't talk down, that had other things to it besides just, you know, the sort of, just hit-and-run kind of fan magazine stuff in it. And the viewers, the fans, the readers responded to it so hungrily. It was really, it was very exciting, very, very exciting to sort of try something that people kind of rolled their eyes at a little bit, you know, like, oh, you know, what does she think she's doing? But she's making money. Let's let her do it. exactly. You know, that's always the bottom line. And I think that, you know, when people started copying us, that was, you know, it was a great, great validation of what we were doing. But, of course, it wasn't so good for business.
Now, you talked a little bit about your background as a critic. In other entertainment genres, such as theater and primetime and film, critical analysis has always been a given. But with daytime, there's almost this underlying attitude that soap journalists should shy away from being too critical of actors or writers to support the industry. Why do you think that is? Why do you think the industry itself doesn't want to be constructively criticized?
Because they never were. And again, that was, you know, was really something that we had a battle against with a battering ram, and that was to teach the industry that they had to accept criticism if they were going to be treated like any legitimate art and entertainment form. And because the so-called journalism up, you know, except for, as I said, with the few exceptions that I mentioned, Linda Hirsch was who I was thinking of in Cleveland. She was syndicated. Because everything was just adoration. Everybody treated the soaps sort of as, they're kind of silly sister who nobody took seriously, but everybody loved. And so nobody ever criticized her because she was a little bit, you know, flighty and not too smart. And, you know, and so the soap industry sort of got used to being handled with nothing but adoration. There was no real such thing as soap criticism. There were a few journalists in the you know, daytime TV days and stuff who would venture forth with a little bit of a something and maybe a little bit of a salvo, but most of it was just complete adoration. And when we came along and we wanted to write criticism, people were taken aback. I mean, when we would get someone a B in rating the replacements, some of those people would never talk to us again.
So
we don't think you're the greatest replacement that ever lived, but we like you. We gave you a B. Drop grading people because it would drive them so crazy if they didn't get like an A+. In my editorials and in talking to, you know, having lunch with producers and in talking to actors and in treating them with we'd say, you know, we treat you with respect and intelligence. And in turn, you have to learn, if you're going to be respected by the rest of the world, is you have to learn to take criticism. We all, everybody in art and in entertainment, it's fair game for criticism. It's not done in mean-spiritedness. It's done because that's what's done. You talk about what's good, and you talk about what needs work. And we just did it. We just did it. And if we had some resistance, some famous resistance, and some quiet behind-the-scenes resistance, but we kept doing it, and we tried to handle it in such a way. I mean, it wasn't, you know, you couldn't be John Simon or Ben Brantley or you couldn't be any of those, you know, the New York Times or any of that. You couldn't come out and really be mean. But we didn't want to be mean anyway. That wasn't our idea. Our idea was to give constructive criticism. Our idea
right.
was idea was to help legitimize our this genre by treating it like any other genre. And you would think that would be just a given, but it wasn't a given because it's not what they were used to. It's not what the industry was used to.
Okay, well, we talked a little bit earlier about how basically compared to today, the soap ratings were really great at the time that you launched the magazine. You witnessed the viewer erosion of post-OJ. I know that a lot of people attribute the OJ Simpson trial to the downward rating slide for daytime soaps. Do you think that is a legitimate?
I think that it was. I think it was one of the first blows. Okay, I certainly you can't hang it all on 2 weeks when there were no soaps, because eventually the soaps did come back and OJ ran on Court TV and other things. What I think happened because of OJ is soaps are an addiction. Soaps are not like any other form of entertainment, although now primetime pretty much runs the same way, which started about with Hill Street Blues, I think. I mean, even primetime is a show of most of the dramas, especially, are soaps. They're continuing stories because people learn that is what causes an addiction to a show. And when people went without that addiction for 2 weeks and lived through it, found other things to do, other ways to fill their time. I think some people maybe felt, you know, you had to watch, you had to watch. And when they found out in their busy lives that, in fact, they didn't have to watch, you know what? They lived just fine without it. Maybe they could check in here or there. Maybe they could pick up the soap magazines and read a little bit in between so they didn't have to watch every day. I think that's what OJ did, was it showed people who were so hardcore that they thought they'd die without their soaps, that they weren't going to die without their soaps. And that was the first step.
Well, I wanted to ask you about something else that is sort of been a focus of the daytime industry as of late, and that is the youth-friendly phenomenon. Since, like, Luke and Laura and the Four Musketeers, and it seems like everything has been focused since then on demos and trying to get that targeted demo. What have been some of the positive and negative effects of the obsession with youth in daytime?
Well, I can't think of a positive one, to tell you the truth. I really can't.
Okay.
There's nothing to be said for it except for the fact, I would say that maybe it attracted some younger viewers who would stay with them, but that's not true, because the kids who sat with their grandmothers and watched soaps didn't care about seeing kids like them. Didn't care about, they were interested in the lives of everybody, of the grown-ups. Most kids also want, I mean, maybe it's a different time now. Kids are more oriented towards their own age groups. But kids who watch soaps, they don't care about watching teenagers that much. They're involved in the family life. They're involved in the drama. They're involved in the group dynamic. And I think that and I think most people will agree, even the advertisers are starting to agree, that this idea of chasing the youth demographic was something born of the advertisers, and then it was passed on to the producers. When this desirable demographic of 18 to 49 was sort of arbitrarily pulled out of somebody's butt. That's about the way I feel about it. It made everybody chase this demographic because that's what advertisers wanted. Advertisers is where the money was. And I think that they convinced themselves that they had to go to a youth market to attract kids who would stay with the business and stay with the stuff, you know, when the older fans died off or went to the old age homes and didn't have TVs, whatever their thinking was. And that, I think, was the second blow to soap operas, is that what they did was alienate many, many, many of their core viewers, mm-hmm. people who didn't want to see an endless parade of pretty, boring kids. There's just so much that teenagers can live through, and they live through it over and over again, and it's really not all that fascinating. I mean, I love kids. I love teenagers, and I think that there are some wonderful characters on daytime and always have been, but that's not an age group that really has interesting lives if you're going to build stories around them. You know, they go to school, they have puppy loves, they have crushes. Okay, sometimes they have sex out of marriage too young, and there's teenage pregnancies to worry about. I mean, okay, but in general, the real exciting things that happen to grown-ups.
I mean,
you may disagree. This is my feeling.
Well, I agree. I mean, the characters I tune in for aren't the younger characters.
No. And even when you were younger, they probably never were.
No.
And that was false thinking on the part of the people in charge. And I think a lot of it had to do with the false premise that was put forth by advertisers, because let's face it, I didn't have any money until I was almost 50. You know,
right.
Most of my friends didn't have any money till they were in their 30s and 40s. I still don't know why. And when you're a kid, they say, oh, get a kid, you know, to buy Colgate at 13 years old and they'll be yours for life. No, well, that's baloney. Kids change their minds about whatever is popular that day. And nobody changes their minds more than teenagers and young people. It's when you get a little bit older, you get set in your ways and you have brand loyalty. So the whole thing was baloney. And not only that, they alienated their longtime viewers by making them think they didn't care about them, which they didn't. If they alienate their longtime viewers, then they don't pass that love on to their daughters and their sons don't, you know, that. And then that's number three, mentoring went down because there weren't as many people at home sitting around the TV. And to me, that was then the third blow to the soaps, is after the pandering to the youth market and making soaps not nearly as interesting, not what they were, and alienating their longtime core older viewers. And when I say older, I mean, you know, people in their 40s and 30s, not necessarily just people way outside the demographic, like in their 50s and 60s and 70s, God forbid. So there was just sort of one thing after another. The mentoring then went down because the older viewers turned away. The kids didn't hang out at home with their grandparents while their mother ironed. They didn't sit with them. They went out. They went to the computers, or they, you know, they did other things. They hung out with their friends. They had iPods. The whole world changed as far as the way people get their entertainment, and you know, soaps demand a lot of attention. You have to watch 5 days a week, 5 hours a week, if you're really going to be there, and that's a lot to ask of people.
Well, we've been talking about some of the things that have caused viewer erosion. One thing that I think has helped a lot of that is that this youth trend has led to a lot of sort of obsession with just finding pretty faces, as opposed to the glory days of soaps, when many of the contract roles were held by theater veterans like the late Beverly McKenzie, who just passed this week, and others.
So heartbroken. Yes, and Ruth Warwick, and movie stars like McDonald Carey and Eileen Hurley, and I mean, one after another, great, really, really fine actors. I mean, not that pretty faces weren't always a part of soaps, but not you know, sort of the gorgeous buff guys, anorexic girls that we have now. And
on 4 days a week.
Yeah, exactly. 4 days a week, and brought in from, you know, a lot of sore assing and a lot of you know, taking sort of the family and making it all, you know, Gidget or whatever it is that kids watch now. Oh my God, I watch a lot of those things. I watch all those teenage shows on TV. So
Gossip Girl,
love Gossip Girl. Except my DVR dropped it on me last night. Anyway. Yeah, I'll find it. So, yes, it did lead to more emphasis on looks than talent, but that doesn't mean that a lot of those young kids don't have talent, too. A lot of them learned on the job, and they learned pretty well, but it's still no substitute for really, really good acting. And, but... Now I'm gonna do the other side, which is soaps are still the best place for, you know, a middle-aged broad to have a job. there are great roles still for the older women, and on almost all the shows, and that for that I have a great deal of respect, and I'm grateful to the show for that, because they do keep these women characters viable. The older guys. All the older actors, too, although it's much easier for an older man than it is an older woman. The soaps actually are better at that than primetime in the movies, really, unless you're, you know, older. I mean, unless you're British, unless you're Judi Dench.
I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned sourcing, and I understand that you're the one who actually coined the term while you were editor of Soap Opera Weekly.
Absolutely didn't. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to brag about that. I always say that's my one greatest contribution to the world of soap operas was coining the phrase SORAS, which stands for Soap Opera Rapid Aging Syndrome.
Did you think it would stick around the way it did?
Well, we used it so much that you know, people did get to know it, but no, of course not. I just did it because I was so tired of trying to explain what happened to this character, since it happened so often, and talking about it. I said, oh, let's just come up with some sort of a shorthand thing. How about Soap Opera Rapid Aging Syndrome? And then we saw that said SORAS, which we thought was a scream. And so we just started talking about SORAS, and that was basically just because I didn't want to keep on writing about, oh, and, you know, so then the kids go off to camp, and then they come back, and then instead of being seven, they're, you know, 43. I mean, how did that happen? Oh, well, you know, they went into puberty while they were at kinder, you know, at day camp. I don't know. But so instead of having to, we just said they were, you know, it was a case of SORAS. And then for the first maybe 6 months, we would explain. We would put in parentheses soap opera rapid aging syndrome. And then we didn't even have to do that anymore.
Oh, so, it should be in the dictionary as the soap industry.
Wikipedia. It's on Wikipedia. I mean, I don't have a bio on Wikipedia, but SORAS does. so that's very good. And when I used to have, when I used to go online, when I used to do I had a board on SoapNet, and I did, you know, chats and different things. And whenever anyone would say or write SORAS, I'd say, you know, I invented that. Because
hey.
I wanted to make sure that I had credit for that, because that was probably going to outlive anything else that I ever said or did in this life, you know.
It's all about branding. There you go.
Exactly. Well, I did write copy for a long time, so. but anyway, that yes, I did invent SORAS. And I'm thrilled about it.
Well, it is a legacy that is used often on the internet among fans. So, I mean, it is a legacy.
It's around, and I get a kick out of it every time I see it. I say, well, there. If only, you know, as long as it stays in Wikipedia, or as the legend goes on, passed on from soap fan to soap fan, I'll never die. I'll always be the person who invented SORAS.
There you go. Now, you left Soap Opera Weekly in 2000, and as you mentioned, you later had your own column at SoapNet.
Actually, I was fired from Soap Opera Weekly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was fired. And, you know, really, to this day, I never really had a very good explanation of why. So it was, I mean, I know why. My art director was also fired. And I know that they never could quite understand why the Digest and the Weekly were, these were new owners. I mean, not new owners. These were our new heads, the new boss of the magazines. And there was a whole new group of people who came in after I'd been there for about 10 years. And they didn't understand why we were in competition. And when I would try to explain that it made both of us better, well, they sort of didn't like, they thought that it would be cheaper and easier and better if we could share everything. So that was number one. I was way, way, way opposed to that. And because the competition was fun, and the competition did keep us on our toes, and it did serve the fans much better by having magazines that were competing for things and that, you know, wanted to be better, wanted people to read them, not the other one, you know. And the other thing is they wanted to change the character of the magazine, and they knew, you know, this was my baby. I wasn't going to budge on that. And also I was making, and so was Susan, we were making quite a bit of money. So it, you know, it made sense. And I was very unhappy. It was a very big shock. It was, amazingly to me, a big industry, you know, brouhaha and story. And, yeah, the magazine's done fine. And I went back, you know, and wrote my column for it after everybody who fired me was fired.
I was going to ask about that. I know that you made a return. These were, of course, back before the days of the internet. Well, the internet was around, but I wasn't really a big internet user at the time. So I knew that you had come back to the magazine for a while, and then I found you on SoapNet.
On SoapNet, right. I was with SoapNet for 5 years, and I started off, I did a lot for the TV show. I was a guest, I think, every week on Soap Center. And when Soap Center started, none of the shows wanted, except for the ABC shows, and they were even reluctant, wanted to, like, let their stars or let people go on the show. For some reason or other, they thought that since SoapNet was owned by ABC, it would make CBS fans leave their shows if they went to SoapNet and saw the ABC shows. I mean, it was just some convoluted way of thinking, which I battled in print and on the phone. And when we started my interview segment, part of it was that people who wouldn't, you know, who sort of wouldn't go and do anything else would agree to come on the show for me to interview them. And because really the networks couldn't legislate and say you can't be on that show, even though they wanted to, people sort of became emboldened. I had a lot of friends in the industry, and they knew they'd be treated well. And then all of a sudden, it was fine. It was cool. People started appearing. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm responsible for this. I'm just saying that was how I started with SoapNet. So I had a relationship with them before, while I was still at the magazine. I did a lot of television for them, and then after I did all the E daytime Emmy pre-shows, the live shows, I went and did it a couple of years for SoapNet also. And then I couldn't have done anything really on SoapNet.com or even on the show. I didn't get my interview spot till I was fired while I was still at the magazine. But then when I was a free agent, they asked me to come over and write my column and have my own board and do chats. And I did a lot of Soap Center. And I was there for about 5 years. And 3 years into that, 3 years after I left Soap Opera Weekly, Carolyn Hinsey called me and said, I have a proposition for you. It always seems to me that good things start with, I have a proposition for you. I mean, in life it doesn't always work out that way, but it has for me in the soap industry. And she said, how would you like to come back and write a column for us? And my first instinct was, are you crazy? You know, I was fired. And then I said, well, let me think about it. And, you know, we talked, and I said what I was interested in. And I said, well, why not? I said, you know, they didn't fire me. The people who fired me are all gone. They were all fired. Everybody was gone. Every head of department head, every person in charge of the magazine and who had been responsible for the changes, you know, firing me and changing things, was gone. So I said, sure, what the heck? It's fun. I love being in print. It's a whole different, you reach a different audience than you do online. And, you know, I enjoyed doing my column. It was good discipline to do it in the short form because I could write until people just fell asleep on online. You know, you never have anywhere. You can just put as much content as you want online. So I did that for 3 years. And then both of the columns ended from budgetary reasons. They didn't want to pay any more for it. So
I want to sort of ask about that and segue, because you wrote the column on SoapNet.com, and it provided you an opportunity to interact with the fans maybe possibly more closely than you would have from a magazine publishing standpoint. Mm-hmm. What do you think of the advent of the internet with blogging and message boards? How has it changed soap journalism? How do you think it has created, say, the rival fan bases? And nowadays, I mean, you mentioned it earlier where people, I mean, you had trouble with people who receive Bs. Well, nowadays, because of the advent of the internet, you can't say hardly anything without being accused of actor bashing, even if it is constructive. What do you think of all of that?
Well, I have very mixed feelings about the internet as far as what it had to do with soaps. I mean, I love the internet. I work on it. I think it's the most amazing, you know, advanced, technological advance of our time. I mean, I think it's changed the world. But as far as what it did to the soap industry and journalism, I don't think it's very good at all. It's certainly, I resisted it for ages. I mean, they tried to, there's a website now, but there was never a website when I was there, because I knew, A, that we would be cannibalizing our own content for free, and B, that we wouldn't be paid to be doing that. And it is true. I mean, the people, all the editors were working double time. And when I, you know, for a while I didn't have the kind of staffing that I ended up with. I mean, you know, we ended up with like 23, 24 people from the initial six. So, I mean, it was quite a climb. But I think that everybody's a critic. That was one of the things that was said by someone at SoapNet, was, oh, why should we pay for criticism? We can get it for free from the fans.
Oh, boy.
And, yeah. And, you know, and that's just great. I mean, I think Soap Opera Weekly had more places for fans to write and that we would air there. I was all for the fans. I was always an advocate of the fans, that, you know, the show should pay attention to the fans, that fans should be respected. You know, we had, I can't remember what it was called on because I can't remember anything, but, you know, we had a section where a fan would write a big letter that got me into a whole lot of trouble once with Doug Marlin, because the fan criticized a murder storyline that went on for a long, 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 long time, and Doug thought that one of us had written it and used a fan's name instead, and that we hid the, oh, and it was just such a brouhaha, and I, you know, I had to explain to him that this was a fan. It didn't necessarily reflect our feelings, although I had written some things about it. And he said, well, you know, why should the fans have as much say as you do? And I said, well, the fans are the people who keep the soaps alive. So I believe the fans should certainly have forum. They should have the opportunity to speak their minds. But that's another. The fans are another voice. They shouldn't usurp all the other voices, all the other critical voices of people who have been in the industry and seen it from all angles, who don't hopefully have the bias of loving one show above others, mm-hmm. of being blind to all but the things that you sort of want to see. Now, I admit, even as a journalist, when Megan McTavish undid Erica's abortion, I mean, I almost had to go to the hospital. I mean, really, I had such apoplexy. And I did have a personal feeling of being incensed over that. But that's okay, you know. It was editorial. It's subjective. It wasn't. It's fine. It wasn't a magazine speaking. But the fans have a whole different perspective than a professional soap journalism does. And I think that the internet is very good for people to get together and to talk and to have fun. But I think all too often it becomes some sort of a force to, as you say, not to not allow criticism of their favorites, except unless they want to do it, unless the fans want to do it, and then they can be. I mean, I know a lot of actors who won't go near the internet. They say, "My God, it just makes them sick to their stomach." The things that they hear, if they paid attention to them all, they'd never leave their houses. They'd never work again. They'd never show their face on camera. They'd never act again. They'd never, you know, wear a dress that showed their arms. I mean, they'd never have another facelift, whatever, which is probably not such a bad idea. But so the fans can be very cruel. But they have every, right to get together and to be together. But I think also all the information that's now available, I think that's hurt the soaps. I'm not sure that our little bit of starting all of that hunger for previews and scoops and news, as much as I told everybody it wasn't going to have any effect on the soaps, it was only going to be good for them because it would create interest, I'm not so sure that it was such a great trend to begin because there's just too much information out there. Everybody knows everything that's going to happen. Our scoops were managed. We worked with the shows. We never gave away more than we were supposed to give away unless it was by, accident. And some things did happen by accident. You thought you could say something. Someone else didn't want you to have said that. We tried to keep the secrets. We tried to give the hints, the reason behind why something is happening and something for you to look out for without giving it away. Once in a while we'd get a scoop, we'd be able to say who murdered someone because it was going to happen on that Monday and we came out maybe on that Friday or that Tuesday. It depended where you were. And now there's nobody telling anybody they can't do anything. It's a free-for-all. So the minute someone gets some information, and there's a lot of people working at shows who like that power of knowing that they can go out there and they can reveal something that then goes all over the internet, and there's hardly a way you can surprise people anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's what the soaps are predicated on. Tune in tomorrow.
Right.
And that was a balance we tried to keep, but that the internet doesn't care about. And there's no way that the internet doesn't care if the shows cut them off and don't give them information to help them toe the line. The internet doesn't care if they're really hurting a show by giving too much information. The internet doesn't care if they really, really, really hurt somebody's feelings horribly and unmercifully because they don't have to work with them again in a couple of weeks. We had all of those things we had to think about and still produce a product that gave the fans what they wanted, gave the shows what they wanted, didn't make the actors too mad, didn't make the writers too mad, and still managed to keep some integrity. And I'll tell you, it's a very tricky balancing act that the internet doesn't even have to think about.
You brought up something that really is timely because I don't know if you're following the whole As the World Turns nuke debate, but they pulled really not a fast one. I guess it's really they just did like soaps in the old days where they really did surprise someone after the whole big campaign of 200 and plus days that the couple didn't kiss. They kissed a couple of weeks ago without any fanfare. No press, no anything, and it really kind of sent many shockwaves through the industry. Do you think that was a good thing that they decided not to?
I think it's a fantastic thing. I think it is so phenomenal, and I didn't even really know that it happened because, I love soaps, but because I have to figure out another way to earn a living. I know that when you wrote to, I think you said something to Nelson about my being retired from the industry. Well, I mean, I'm not retired because I necessarily wanted to retire from it. I mean, there's just not that much place again where people really want to pay money for criticism or for a column or for. But since I am retired more or less from the soap industry, I find that I don't feel the need or the desire to watch soaps as much, which is quite surprising to me after having watched almost all of them every day for the last God knows how many years. I only watch a few of them all the time now. I do other things. I'm in and out. If I have a chance, I watch my DVR. If I don't, I don't. And there's some soaps that I really only watch maybe once a week. World Turns had gotten sort of boring for a while, so I had turned away from it. But I do love the Luke story, and I'm so happy to hear you say that. I think that that's first of all, that's the way it should be, okay? This is, you know, the 21st century. It shouldn't you shouldn't have to alert the media because a gay character is going to kiss another gay character. And I remember when Days of Our Lives did the same thing with, I think it was Mimi's abortion. It just happened.
Mm-hmm.
She talked about it for a minute or two, a day or two with, you know, Adele, and all of a sudden she had an abortion, and we hadn't heard anything about it. There wasn't any kind of a, and I had a great deal of respect that Days did that. Of course, Mimi Farrah-Fath's character suffered, you know, the crises of the damned because of it. Naturally, but at least it was just sort of done. And Bianca and Lena, after the original, you know, kiss heard round the world, there were many kisses after that between Kelly O'Hara and Bianca on New Year's Eve or whatever, and they just did it. And to me, that's the way it should be. But so I think it's a great thing. And are they suffering repercussions? Is that what you're telling me? Since I'm sort of
no, actually, well, it wasn't repercussions. I think it was just that we jaded soap journals and amateur soap journals were like, whoa, that wasn't spoiled 3 months ago,
and it wasn't even hinted at in the magazine. So it was like, okay, this sort of took everybody by surprise.
Right. And you know what? I used to, even at the magazine, I used to so appreciate being surprised. And I have a lot of stories about that. But my favorite one is when Maggie Reed, Shannon, after she'd had her head shrunk in the jungle, she was a friend of mine, and she called me and said, "I'm going back to the show." You're kidding. Your head is shrunk. I mean, it sounds like Whoopi Goldberg, but he has no head. I'm so pissed. So she said, "Yeah, I know, but they figured it out, and I'm going back." I said, "Well, can I do anything with this?" She says, "Well, you probably shouldn't." She says, "But you know, you can find." I said, "Well, I'll call CBS. I'll call the press office, and I'll ask." She said, "Okay." I said, "Oh, don't worry, I won't." I said, "Don't tell anybody else yet, okay?" She said, "No, I won't." I said, "No, and I won't do anything about it, you know, until I talk to the powers that be." But meanwhile, by that time, I think there were quite a few other magazines, and all of a sudden, everybody was doing news, and there was a lot of competition for stories and for scoops. I mean, no one had ever heard of scoops in soap opera journalism. Now, scoops was the thing. So I called the press office and spoke to someone who I probably knew for 20 years, and I said, "Hey, I hear Shannon's coming back." Dead silence. Dead. I mean, literally 10 seconds of heavy breathing and dead silence. And the publicist said, "Mimi, can you hold on to that? Can I get back to you on that?" I said, yeah, I won't do anything until it's confirmed. Don't worry. The next thing I know, I get a phone call maybe 20 minutes later, for all I know, from Lori Caso, who was the executive producer at the time. And he said, "Mimi, I've called to talk to you about Shannon." I said, "Great." I said, "Is she coming back?" He said, "Yes, she is, but I'd like to ask you not to reveal it." He said, "Because if you do, you're going to ruin 3 months of really, really interesting plotting that leads up to the..." I said, "Well," I said, "I'm happy not to do it." I said, "But, you know, if I know this..." I said, "Maggie said she's not going to tell anyone else, but if I know this, then, you know, someone from the Digest is going to hear about it. Someone from Soap Opera Magazine, if it was around then, is going to hear from it. Someone from In Depth is going to hear. Someone from, you know, there, whatever was around there." I said, "You know, I'm sitting on this fantastic scoop, and you're asking me to sit on it, which I'm happy to do, but how do I know it's not going to be taken from me?" He said, "Let me take care of that. I'll get back to you." And he got on the phone, and he called all the editors, and everybody agreed to keep it a secret. And we did. And when Shannon returned from the dead with a full head, it was like, oh wow. And the soap journalists got together with, you know, we had understandings. We tried very hard to work with the shows. We didn't want to ruin the soaps. We didn't want to ruin something like that. And but it was very hard because there was a certain 5 or 6 year period in there when all of a sudden there were a gazillion soap magazines and outlets, and everybody wanted to be the first with a scoop. And you had to weigh the fact of, were you going to ruin something, or were you going to not break a story and see someone else do it, and then you get left out in the cold. You don't seem like the person who's getting the news. And what we finally ended up, I think, being known as was the place you could go for the truth. We didn't do speculation. We didn't do, at the time that I was there, stories that don't give names, unattributed stories. All my editors signed their stories. We all had bylines. That doesn't, I think, exist anymore. Everything we did, we accounted for, and unless we had gotten confirmation on something, every once in a while we would say, this is unconfirmed, if we knew absolutely for sure it was true and it wasn't going to kill anything. But I think a surprise, and really it's interesting, the last time I was, I think, really surprised was also something As the World Turns did later on with Lily. I'm sorry that there's not more of them. I think it's another thing that's hurt, so that there's too much information.
You talked a little bit earlier.
I talked a lot earlier.
No, I mean, you're basically giving me great segues. You mentioned my next question was, one of the things that I remember about your SoapNet column and the message board is that, like many of us in the soap world, or most of us, you were beyond appalled by All My Children's decision to rewrite the Erica Kane abortion storyline. Many would agree that was probably the start of a pretty significant downward spiral for All My Children. Why do you think the powers that be decided to tamper with such a groundbreaking story, not just for AMC, but for daytime as a whole?
Well, first of all, I think that All My Children had started to go down significantly for a long time. I think starting with Bianca's rape, which was, I think, Megan's and maybe the network's way of sort of backing out of their groundbreaking lesbian story, because now she had a girlfriend. They'd kissed. We saw the morning after once, and then what is there left to do unless you let them be a couple, unless you show them having their relationship increasing, you show them having more physical contact. We didn't necessarily have to have sex. And I think that in backing away from that, that's where the show started to take, again, that violent turn. They had Bianca raped. She got pregnant. She kept the baby. I mean, they ended up doing, and then the baby switch. I mean, I know that the show actually did pretty well at that point, but it kind of lost its way. It was doing everything for sensationalism. And I think that they were losing their contact with their idea of what it was that fans wanted out of the show. And I don't know why Brian Franz let it go on for so long. I don't know why Agnes Nixon, whom they swore signed off on it. I cannot imagine Agnes Nixon saying, oh, sure, go ahead, ruin this historic story that's in all the history books, the first legal abortion on daytime TV. It's historic. Go ahead and not only insult the viewer's intelligence, but make it the stupidest story since Vicky went to heaven on a spaceship. And, give Erica a grown son she doesn't need. I mean, I have no idea. I can't imagine Agnes saying that's okay. And what probably happens is it didn't matter to them if Agnes said it was okay. And then the next question is, well, why did anybody think it was okay? And that's, again, a lack of respect for the audience, some kind of lack of understanding of what it is that people really want, and some kind of, I don't know, ego trip, some kind of need to be, do whatever you want to do and damn the consequences. I have no idea. But it was appalling for so many reasons. So many reasons. And I mean, the show basically lost me. That was sort of it for me.
Well, it sort of leads to a question that I wanted to ask about, because it seems like nowadays, with every new writing regime, everybody's just trigger happy to take and go in and write it how they want, and not necessarily pay attention to the history. Why do you think it is that soap writers have gotten to that point where it's a matter of their vision as opposed to honoring the history?
Well, again, I think it's because they don't care about the viewer that cares about history. I think it's still that, you know, pandering to the youth element that doesn't necessarily know the history or care about it. I think maybe they're running out of things to do and say. You know, it's pretty hard being a soap writer. I have to say, in soap writers' defenses, having written some scripts, it's very, very hard to have to move on and be constantly tethered to the past by viewers with long memories, by shows that history is so much a part of. But whoever said it was going to be easy?
Right.
You know, you signed on for the gig, and you have to think of interesting ways to do things, which is why people come back from the dead, and you know, why a lot of silly things that we accept as convention happen, and why we accept them more or less willingly. It's because we know if something is going to continue forever, although I have my doubts now that it's going to be forever, you have to give writers and give them a certain amount of latitude. You have to allow them to do things that don't happen in real life, because otherwise it's boring. You know, otherwise, you know, everybody could write a book about a certain portion of their lives, but how many people could you follow their lives for 30 years and still find every minute of it interesting? I mean, so there's got to be a little bit of latitude in what we'll accept as reality, but there are certain things that are sacrosanct. I'm sorry, there are certain things that you do not tamper with.
Amen.
And one of them is Erica's abortion. Okay?
Amen.
Yes, amen. And I could probably name a few other things, but nothing at the moment can I recall that makes my, you know, I can see my blood. It's sort of boiling onto the surface of my skin now just thinking about it. To me, was ever such a blatant slap in the face to the genre, to the fans, to Agnes, to feminism, to it was just horrific in every way. Can you tell? It really pissed me off.
Yes, I could tell on the boards back then.
Yeah, well, it wasn't just the boards. I mean, I have to say, SoapNet and Soap Opera Weekly were fantastic. Except in the beginning of SoapNet, while they were sort of learning about me, and they got nervous about things, nobody has ever sort of told me that I couldn't speak my mind, which, mm-hmm. you know, was the names of my columns mostly. It was called Inside the Soaps at SoapNet, but still was the same kind of thing. Most of the people I worked for, including my big bosses at Soap Opera Weekly, have let me pretty much have my head. And I think there was one point where Carol and Hinsey said, okay, I think we have to, you know, we have to just stop with Erica's abortion for a couple of weeks, okay? Okay, I'll stop. Anyway, it's about old news. But between the boards and my columns, I just couldn't let it go.
There's a lot of things. I mean, there are things like that come up on these shows where you just can't let them go, whether it be from a fan standpoint or whether it be from your standpoint. However, on the flip side of things, on our podcast, we talk about on occasion the fact that if we weren't doing the podcast, if we weren't doing the blog, there are several soaps that we just simply wouldn't watch anymore because they've, for whatever the reason, whether it be they've lost their soul, their writing has went downhill, whatever it may be. You mentioned earlier that you still watch some soaps on occasions. Which of those do you still watch on occasions, and which one is piquing your interest the most?
Well, I'll tell you, even though it's just dreadful in certain ways, I am still a Guiding Light fan. And I think it's because the acting is so superb on that show. There are so many fantastic actors on that show. And even if they drop threads of storylines. They jump around. I mean, I don't know if David's drinking. I don't know. I'm only kidding. He's fabulous. I mean, he's if he could just hold a thread, he'd almost be like Pam Long in sort of the emotional tenor of the storylines. And because the show, there's something about the show, even though it's got a whole lot of, you know, stuff that I would change, it still holds my interest. I still care about those characters. I'm interested in the fact that they tried something new that I think is kind of interesting. It's more realistic. It's more, not that that's what we watch soaps for, but it is a little more like prime time to have the real locations and the fuller sets and the places that look real, especially now that they've gotten their sound down a little bit. The sound used to drive me crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, it was so terrible. It was so hollow, or it had wild, you know, the wild sound of the winds blowing and all of that stuff. So Guiding Light, I still watch Guiding Light every day. I watch Young and Restless even though it could almost be an instant sleeping pill. and I don't know why. It's getting a little bit more interesting again. But I got so tired of Gloria.
Sorry.
I loved Judith, and I think when she came on, she was fresh and fabulous, but then it became the Gloria show, and Gloria hasn't been there that long that it should be the Gloria show, you know? And too much business, you know? But there's still something about it. I guess it's its intelligence, the quality of its performances. I really, really am a sucker for good acting, and there are so many fabulous actors on that show. So I still watch that. B&B is a hoot, and it comes after Y&R, and I don't care what they say about the hammock having nothing to do with their popularity. It does. And it's kind of entertaining. It goes up and it goes down, but it's almost never boring, even if you do watch the same story over and over again for the last 20 years. And then that's about the only things I watch almost every day. I try to watch GH, but I'm not really interested in it. I've been watching World Turns again because I found it to be very good, but it was boring me. So rigid, I just couldn't pay any attention. I wasn't interested in what was going on One Life to Live, even though I don't know why. I just wasn't. I just didn't care. And all my children, I tuned back in to see Jesse and Angie return and how they were going to work that out, and it was okay. I was, you know, willing to go for it. But the rest of it just, I don't care. I'm tired. To me, as wonderful as David Canary is, Adam has been doing the same thing for 20 some odd years. I'm tired of it. I want people to grow and to change, and they don't grow and change enough. So that to me is what I want to see. I want to see characters change, and there's not much of that going on. And I don't watch Days. I stopped watching Passions ages ago. I always used to say I just didn't get paid enough to watch the NBC show. I know that's terrible, and I know people will hate me, and there are wonderful things about Days of Our Lives, and there were hilarious things about Passions, and I liked it in the beginning. I found it to be quite fun and intriguing. But let's face it, it's not, you know, in oblivion for no reason. Although, God knows there are good soap that are gone that shouldn't be. And I'm just not, I just don't care. Why don't I care?
Do you think it's fatigue? I mean, in terms of, do you think that soaps, because of their longevity, that in addition to the addiction factor, that it's just a matter of fatigue?
Maybe. Maybe it's, you know, there's something we always talked about. A writer gets fired on one show and they get hired on another show. They get fired on that show. They go back to, how many times did Megan go back to All My Children? 3 times?
Mm-hmm.
They need new blood, and that's why Kreitzman, even though he's you know, he makes mistakes and stuff, there's a certain vitality to his writing, and I think that I don't know if I know that ABC used to have a writers program. I was with it until actually progressing quite happily with it until the person who was head of it was given early retirement and went off to bigger and better things. But I don't think they have their writer development programs anymore. And so it's still the same old people writing soaps. They've been writing soaps for 1,000 years. Wouldn't you be tired? I mean, it is an exhausting job. I remember Pam, when Pam was writing Guiding Light, and she said, Mimi, I do not have a life. There is no life to this. And it's exhausting. It's just exhausting, and I think they need new blood.
Is there any way that that can even take place? I mean, I know it sounds stupid, but the industry keeps losing ratings. What would appeal to a young writer to try and break into that genre if it wasn't for a passion of having grown up on it? How are you going to get stars from or writers from primetime to try and jump to soaps?
I don't think you need writers from primetime. I think how about the young kid who's been a fan all their life and loves the genre and needs to be nurtured in a writer development program to become a writer? We don't need people from primetime.
They
we
told me I wrote
blood.
Over the top.
Pardon?
No, I said they told me I wrote over the top. I submitted to the ABC Daytime program, and I was told my writing was over the top.
Well, you see, if they had found something, though, if there had been a real ongoing program. I mean, the first script I submitted, there were problems with it, and I worked with Molly, and I got better. Because,
right.
I knew the form intrinsically. I write good dialogue. Maybe your first effort, but you have a passion for it. If you can write, there should be people who can mold people with passion and writing talent to be able to. Not everybody can write for the soap. It's very, very hard. The first script I ever wrote for the soap, oh, God, 25 years ago, I remember the head of writer development was for CBS said, Mimi, if you were writing for primetime, I would hire you tomorrow. I said, but this is a whole, 3 weeks worth of story you just put in this script. You have to learn how to attenuate things. You have to learn how to stretch them out. And, it has to be taught. And there are some people who have an affinity for it and some people who don't, but those people they need to go out and they need to bring in fresh minds, people who aren't tired, people who haven't seen it all and haven't done it all. And if there are a lot of young writers. I don't think you're going to get anybody from Grey's Anatomy to come over and write, Days of Our Lives or As the World Turns. But there's certainly a lot of young writers out there with a lot of talent who would be happy to write professionally and get in the Writers Guild for anything they can do. And there are a lot of people who are soap fans who would sell their mothers to have that opportunity, who very likely could do it. Most of my junior staff on Soap Opera Weekly were interns, and a lot of them started off as fans who would write to us, and then when they went to school, when they went to college, they'd come and they'd be interns, or some of them even started in high school. And
like Nelson.
Exactly. And Mark McGarry was still in high school when he started interning for me. Anyway, most of my junior staff started off as interns, and I let them start writing right away. And we figured out how to pay them a little bit by giving them a little bit, making them have sort of a freelance status because they worked very hard. And we developed writers. I developed a staff that I was able to train practically from the ground up to the Soap Opera Weekly way. And it was just giving people an opportunity, finding talent, and nurturing them on a much smaller scale. But that's what they need to do with soaps. They need to find people with a passion for the industry, not people who are so tired of writing the same old thing for the last 30 years that they could just slit their wrists rather than write another storyline. No wonder everything is recycling or they're undoing history. I mean, how much can the brain take? And that's not to put them down. I think that they are amazing. I think that soap writers are so amazing. But they do wear out. There is burnout factor like mad. And just resting, just leaving one soap and going to another, is not going to help the burnout factor. It's still the grind. And it's a grind.
We sure hope that a lot of soap execs are listening right now because you are giving out golden advice. Since leaving, or not leaving, we would love to have you back definitely. In fact, if you ever wanted to write for us, we'd love it.
If you want to pay me, I'd be thrilled. I mean, I'm happy to go out there and write about soaps to anybody who wants to. I mean, it's how I make my living, besides photography. I'm actually, that's what I'm working on now is my photography website. But I'm perfectly open to going and expressing my opinions or writing, any columns for daytime or primetime. If it's just people don't want to pay. They don't want to pay writers anymore. They want to get it all for free. And you know, I can't compete with that. I mean, I love giving my opinion. You can tell, but I don't want to. You know, it's how I make my living. It doesn't make sense for me to spend several hours a day doing something that I need to do to pay the bills.
Yep.
You know? So I would love to work with you and write for you and do all of that stuff. And if there, you know, if there's any salary, let me know. I'm happy to come and talk, though, all the time.
Oh, definitely.
I'm happy to come and talk.
That's awesome.
For free.
Well, we appreciate it. You have no idea.
Well, listen, you guys are great, and you're smart, and you ask good questions, and you care about the industry, and it's not – I am so tired of – I mean, another thing, it's another good reason, actually, that I'm not in this doing what I was doing is I'm so sick of celebrity journalism that I could just scream. I could never be doing it, and that's what it's all – that's mm-hmm. what it's about now. And it's just so boring. It's just so boring. And it's so invasive.
And that's one thing we don't do. We don't do the who's dating who or anything like that.
No, and I appreciate that. So, and I know the fans appreciate it. You know, there are people out there who care about ideas. They care about things that are interesting. It's not necessarily gossip and garbage and the same old stuff. And I don't know where those people are getting any of that except from places like from you.
Wow, we appreciate that so much. I wanted to ask you.
No, you are not talking too long. We are just sitting here enjoying your take on what has happened.
Definitely.
This is just my opinion, mind you. So.
Hey, that's what we do all day long, every day. But I wanted to ask you, since leaving SoapNet.com, you've embarked on a new creative endeavor, or maybe not embarked. You might have been doing it all along, but you have your own photography business now. Tell us a little bit about that.
I always took pictures. I always had a pretty good eye, and I really enjoyed it. But I live in New York, and it was very hard. If I wanted to do my own printing and developing, I had to, you know, do it in a little room in my other room and hang up curtains and throw away. You know, you couldn't keep anything out. It was impossible. So I sort of lost. I still took pictures, but I didn't do any work. And then when digital came in, I really, really, really got into it. And I spent half the year in Martha's Vineyard. And I don't know if you have ever been there, if you know Cape Cod, or you know the vineyard. It's just the most beautiful place on earth. I mean, really, it is so gorgeous. And I started taking pictures really seriously there, and I started working with a gallery there. And all of a sudden, it turned out people really loved my photos. And I've been trying to put together a website for a year, but my father was ill, and I wasn't able to do anything much but that last year. And I have a temporary site. I mean, it's mimitorchinphotography.com. You can go and you can see a slideshow. You can't buy anything yet, but that's what I'm working on now. And I do. I was just in a show at the International Center of Photography in New York, and I'm in a few collections. And slowly but surely, I'm really, really loving it. I always have loved the visual. I used to pick all the main photographs for the magazine. I had a great photo editor, and Patty Carroll, and I worked very closely with all the photographers. I went to many of the shoots. I don't know if you remember or not, even though we were on the world's worst paper, we had gorgeous photography.
Yes, you did. And I was going to mention that. That was one of my favorite things of the old way the magazine, there was always this big, great picture. It's kind of gone more to, you know, to compete with more
now.
Stars. Right. But I love those big.
They were great, and we, you know, that was really part of the fun of the magazine. Was it? I had wonderful artists and a terrific designer, and I think that we were always fighting against our paper. I mean, my one battle that I never gave up on, but never except for a few specials, was to get better paper. But the magazine was selling just fine on crappy paper, so there was no reason, I guess, they thought to upgrade it, and it was just my own ego and my own desire to, you know, have the product be everything that it could be. But we did our best, and one of the things we had was great photography. And so now I'm indulging in my own. I do mostly art photography. I do scenic stuff, and although I do some street photography in New York, and you know, it's building. It's starting, and I hope the website will be done in about a month. But there is a slideshow there, and you can just get an idea of the kind of stuff I do. I'd love to share it with people, just to take a look at it again. And it doesn't mean I want to give up writing. But if this is all I do for the rest of my life, I'd be very, very happy doing it. It's really fulfilling.
Well, we will definitely post. Oh, definitely, and we will definitely post a link on the blog. Well, Mimi, we have enjoyed this hour so much. It's been
a
tremendous
pleasure.
Oh, yes, most definitely.
You guys are so smart. And thank you for letting me rant and rave.
Oh, hey, anytime. We greatly appreciate it, and it's just been wonderful to listen because I'm a newer soap viewer than even, say, Jamie. And so for myself, to be able to get the more long-range perspective is just wonderful.
Well, the soaps are great. I don't want to discourage anybody who might, you know, who's on the fence about them. I mean, I think if you can devote the time to them, they're still again, the acting is superb. There are great actors on daytime, and it's a thrill just to see them work. It's just that I think that we need some fresh stories. That's all. I think that would help. I don't know if it's going to save the industry at this point. It may have to go to cable. It may have to do other things. It may have to change. I think it's going to go through some kind of a change, but I think it'll always be with us in some form.
Well, we thank you for being with us today, and
we
will post your website on the blog. And
great.
Thank
again,
you.
Again, it's just a slideshow now, but enjoy.
Once you get the official site up, let us know, and we will post a link on it, the blog at that time as well.
I will. I would love that. That would be fantastic.
Well, thank you so much.
It was a lot of fun, guys. Jamie, give my regards to Texas. Okay.
Will do.
Daughter sends its best to the ether.
I'll have a margarita tomorrow and toast you.
Guacamole. Okay, great.
Yes,
okay, I'll
go.
Talk to you guys soon. Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.